Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. I don't know if this one's for everyone. You know, this is a tough one. We're here today because Kim Shattuck of the Muffs has passed away. She was a guest on my show 5 times, at least, over the years. Some live appearances, some phone interviews, one solo acoustic, once with the Pandoras, once with the Muffs. She was, quite simply, one of my favorite songwriters, and really, I do believe she is one of the greatest songwriters ever to exist. So she passed away age 56 just this week, and I had sort of heard a rumor that she was sick, but I did not know that she was that it was going to be, you know, fatal and so quick. And it was really tough. What a tough, horrible situation. And, you know, I hope this point gets across in this conversation with Ronnie, the bass player of the Muffs, but she was a really interesting, unique person, and I think that was all reflected in her songs. So, you know, if you're interested in the Muffs, check out the archives, because all those interviews are up there, and, you know, buy her records, listen to her music forever, because I know the songs will live forever. And that's all. I don't, you know, not too much to tell you. Just I will miss her. She was total one of a kind, and I was happy every time that we crossed paths. So here it is, my talk with Ronnie Barnett of the Muffs, as we pay tribute to the late, the great Kim Shattuck. That is, of course, the Muffs. I get it. I'm pretty sure that's Ronnie singing there, or maybe it's singing in quotes. I think when Ronnie was on the show, he was like, turn my mic down to zero. But good morning, Ronnie, and welcome to the program. I know this has been a really terrible, crazy week for you, and I really appreciate you, A, waking up early and just taking the time for us.
Yeah, Michael, I didn't know there was a 9 o'clock in the morning until right now, so this is... Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Thanks for playing that song. Yeah, that's me. Kim made me sing that song, and she wrote it, and God, I hadn't thought about this. She wrote it as kind of an apology to her, the time she was mean to me over the years. So it's kind of a sweet, it's a very sweet sentiment, yeah.
That's so interesting. I mean, you guys had such a complex relationship in a band for, you know, 29 years, and I guess you knew her for longer, and I guess you were romantic partners for a while. And just being in a band, you know, you're in a rehearsal room, you're on a stage, you're in a van, you're never more than 10 feet away from, you're in the Waffle House. It's complex, you know, and I'm sure you must be feeling a lot of just crazy complexity.
Oh, yeah. She's very important in my life. Yeah, we met in 86 in a... We hit it off as friends, and I lived in Texas at the time, and yeah, in 89, we kind of became a couple, and I decided to move to California, and a couple years later, yeah, I ended up in my girlfriend's band. I wasn't meant to do this, you know, but that was my destiny, you know, so.
How interesting. I mean, one of the, you know, Facebook can really, excuse me, really drive you up the wall sometimes. But I have been truly comforted by the incredible outpouring of just stories about how Kim, as a person, touched people's lives, or how the band or the music or the songs or interactions people had with her, or, you know, times she went out of her way to make people feel good, or funny thing she did. I mean, it's really been, I've never seen anything like this on Facebook ever.
No, it really is overwhelming, and it's really so good to see. I mean, I keep, people keep comparing it to, like, you know, Bowie and Prince, when that was the such an overwhelming response. But yeah, I don't know if it's because, like, most of my Facebook friends, like, are going to, you know who the band is, but yeah, like, you're right. I'm reading stories I didn't know. I'm seeing pictures I've never seen, and, yeah, everyone is just, yeah, it's been very sweet. Now, I want to say, I don't know where all these people were while we were out there playing. I'm just kidding. They were there. When you're around as long as us, and, you know, we never broke up, even though, you know, some of the articles say we broke up. You know, we did take a break of 3 years at one point, you know, after a really, really happy record. But, you know, we never really broke up. So, you know, I'm proud of that. And I was always proud of, you know, the people that did like our band, you know, tended to like us a lot. And that's really seeing all the tributes and people's getting emotional and you can tell that we really affected people.
Yeah. I think it's more content from than with David Bowie or Prince, because you guys were much more accessible. You know, you could go talk to Kim after the show and ask her a question or kiss her or take a picture with her or whatever, you know. And so there's so many more personal connections, because for so many years you guys toured clubs after clubs after clubs after clubs. And, you know, I guess I wasn't surprised, but I guess didn't expect to personally feel comforted by the computer and by all that community. So, yeah.
Yeah, me too. No, so thanks to everybody for, you know, putting their emotions and posting and telling all these stories, and, you know, it still continues.
Yeah.
And Kim would be so happy to read that stuff, and she'd be so happy to know she's getting press everywhere and you know, getting her name on the Roxy sign it's been beautiful in that respect.
Yeah. So tell me, I mean, so this she was in the Pandoras, and that's when I first knew of her and, you know, first saw her. And then she, you know, still really young and still, you know, new to the band scene and the rock and roll scene. And did she just say, I'm going to start writing songs, and just started doing it? And when you first heard those early songs, was it apparent that she was one of the greatest songwriters ever?
I mean, she... You know, when I moved her in '89, we became a couple. Yeah, she had already, you know, had some songs. You know, I guess I should explain, the Pandoras was led by a woman named Paula Pierce, who was the leader of that band, and Paula wrote all the songs for the Pandoras. So Kim, you know, that wasn't her vision, and by '89, the Pandoras, they'd gone through a few stylistic changes, so they were. Paula was into the glam heavy metal stuff of that day. So the Pandoras at that time, you know, were trying to be a hard rock heavy metal band, and they really had lost their audience. You know, they weren't playing to many people, and they were trying to be on these bills with heavy metal bands, and that wasn't working. And Kim was, you know. Kim was frustrated by that. She would talk about that. And yeah, she had this stockpile of songs. I remember I played. She had she had one of those old four-track recording devices, and she was running songs. I remember she found out I played bass, and she had me play bass on a song. And we even went in a. This is the great lost Muff part of Muff, or, you know, one of them. We tried out this drummer named Murdoch. Which didn't work out. I don't know his first name. I don't know if Murdoch was his first name, last name. I wouldn't know him if I saw him, but we went and actually played with a drummer. And, you know, Kim was getting increasingly frustrated with the Pandoras, and you know, we were best friends with Melanie and her husband at the time, and Melanie had, they had let her go because they didn't want keyboards in the band, and you know, and they had this tour of Europe coming up about a month later, and Paula pulled out of the tour the week they were supposed to go. I remember Kim calling me up and saying, like, I quit the band. I'm done with this. And I remember at the time being like, you can't quit the band. What do you mean? This is a, you know, and she's like, no, we'll have our own band. And, you know, literally within 2 months, in fact, it makes 29 years this month, October of 1990. We found a drummer, and Melanie had started learning guitar, and we started practicing. So within 2 months of her quitting the Pandoras, we already had a set of songs, and we're practicing. Mm.
So. And were those songs, did they blow your mind?
Yes, some of them, though the songs did get better. After we formed our band, I'm trying to think what the first wave of songs was. I mean, the first wave of songs was like those the early single songs, things like Guilty and I Don't Like You, and you know, New Love. That was kind of the early batch. Some ones that like didn't make it, and it was the second batch. The second wave of songs had Lucky Guy and I Need You and you know, Saying Goodbye, and she really, I think she was inspired to kind of step up her game, and she certainly did. And
yeah,
of course. I mean, as we both know, being music lovers, songs do not grow on trees, and I know that's why our band, you know, lasted so long and has such a reputation. It's really, you know, about the songs.
I completely, totally agree. I mean, when it comes down to, I mean, you guys put the songs over every time, great, on record and live, and the Muffs were the Muffs. You know, it was a three-piece situation, you know, well, once Roy joined. But the songs, you know, and for me, when I think about her personality and all the different ways people describe her personality, all of those words were kind of wrapped up in the songs. It was like, yes, that's the person that wrote all these songs. I mean, did she say, I want to write songs as good as so-and-so, or did she listen to something, or was there like a holy grail for her, or was it just an organic thing inside her?
It was Kim had a disservice to say narrow focus, but she liked what she liked. She liked melodic, hooky songs that were based in like that 60s style songwriting. Like she loved Herman's Hermits and she loved the Kinks and, you know, stuff like that, Small Faces, you know? So she, and I think she had said this before in interviews, she wanted to hear songs that she liked, and she wasn't hearing them. So she wrote them. And, then she just had this incredible gift of putting these chords together in weird, you know, they're misleadingly simple sounding. They're actually, not all of them, but a lot of them are quite complex. They have a lot of chords and they do weird things and I mean, she just had a gift for that. And that's, as a friend of mine pointed out, I mean, it's a hard area to work in because it's very easy to write mediocre pop songs.
Yeah.
But to write, you know, to write them like she did, she was special.
Is she really?
That's why every time I would ask, like, Ronnie, do you want to write songs? Like, no, I don't have, you know, I really think it's something you're born with or you're not. Like, I know you can learn about songcraft and structure and stuff, but I really think you're born with it or not. And she had it.
Yeah, she totally had it. And the idea to do what you were talking about, like, sometimes there'll be a minute and 56 second long Muff song. It'll have like 300 chord changes in it, and like you know, four parts and two bridges, and you're like, how does she pack it all in? Because it's like this unrelenting hookiness.
No, we would have like a song like On and On. It's like a minute 50, and it's, you know, it's got two verses, three choruses, a bridge, solo.
Yeah, very economical.
No, and then it'd be like, well, she'd be like, oh, that's it. Why make it any longer? That's the song.
Yeah.
Have you heard the new one yet?
Yeah.
Okay. Because, yeah, like, you know, as you know, it starts off with a 30-second song. That's, you know, it's
like a jingle almost, yeah.
Yeah. It sounds complete.
So was she a hard worker? I mean, was it like, don't bother me, I'm writing songs? Or was she, because I think she, you know, she was always writing in notebooks. But when did she work on the songs and hammer them out forever? Or was it easier than that?
I think they seemed to come out in spurts. She'd get on a writing jag and then like would come up with like five incredible songs at a time. You know, we were on that, it's a cliche, but we were on that whole make a record, tour the record, write the record, make a record. You know, we were on that cycle for a while. And, you know, yeah, like, say that, you know, the bridge to the second record, I mean, most of those songs were written for that record. You know, they weren't, it wasn't like stuff hanging around. You always hear that about the second record, you know, it's all the kind of lesser songs that didn't make the first record. And it is that way for a lot of bands. But yeah, no, she was always writing. I mean, anytime we played, we generally were playing at least a couple of new songs.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You know, that weren't out yet, even if we had a brand new record.
One of the interesting about your guys' career, the Muffs' career, is that you guys were signed to a huge major label, and, you know, kind of went through that ringer of the pressure and the money and the videos, you know, and the money. And I'm sure there was a pressure on her to, you know, write that hit single or change the sound or whatever. And it seems to me that she never, that she stayed true to herself through that tremendous pressure.
Yeah. You know, we were lucky in our situation. And I gotta say, Warner Brothers always had that kind of reputation as artist friendly,
yeah.
You know, back then. Of course, things are completely different now. But you know, we were lucky to, we got signed in that post Nirvana grunge wave of bands getting signed, and you know, we ended up, we had the right A&R guys. I do not have any stories, those horror stories you hear where like the A&R guys say, we don't hear a single, write more songs, you know, demo more songs. I mean for better or worse, I mean, they let us kind of do what we wanted to do. You know, we never had like trendy producers or you know, Andy Wallace mixing a single, you know, that kind of thing,
right?
And that said, you know, maybe we weren't the highest priority at the label, but the thing that's telling is, like, those Warner Brothers records, those three records, they've never went out of print. Like, they have never gone out of print. And our contemporaries at the label at the time, you know, bands like Mudhoney and Babes in Toyland, those records are long out of print, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, even when the remaster or, you know, those deluxe editions of them came out, they weren't out of print on Warner Brothers.
Yeah, so. I didn't know that. That's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, and I don't know how deep you want to go into this, but, you know, our second record, you know, got the biggest push because that was the kind of the, after Green Day Dookie came out, I know the story is often told, but, you know, Green Day signed to Warner Brothers. They were fans of our record, and they signed with our same A&R guy. They took our same management, our booking agent, all of our business people, and so that's why we switched to Reprise and got kind of a bigger push with Blonder and Blonder and did the $60,000 video. And
oh my god,
you know, it's crazy to think. Like, I mean, you know, our third record, we spent $200,000 on it.
Oh wow!
But I mean, you know. Back then, we were recording, and you know, you had to record in a big studio. You know, we recorded that record in a room next to Eric Clapton making his record. You know, like,
yeah.
That's which cool. Is hilarious, and you know,
yeah,
and all that money is just studio. You know, just basically, Kim was such a perfectionist then that you know we would just use as much money as we were given.
Hmm.
So
that's amazing.
You know, for better or worse, those records stand up, and I think that's why, because we didn't use trendy producers, and we were not, you know, there is some dated stuff on the first record, but other than that, I think that they all kind of stand up.
Oh yeah, there's just every record is part of the Muffs story. Tell me about, I mean, I know that she did photography, I know that she loved the Dodgers, but you know, sort of in that Beatles Help way, I kind of have an image of Kim waking up in the morning and pulling off the covers, and she's wearing that little dress already, you know, and she just is Kim from the moment. But, I mean, what else did she do? What did she do during years, months, when you weren't on tour? What did she, you know, how did she pay the bills? What did she like to eat, you know?
Yeah, Kim, well, I got to say, your assessment is not far off. She basically did wake up and was that person off stage every day. She, I'll put it this way. There was one time where she got a job. Roy's wife worked at like a law firm, and they got Kim like some kind of filing job. Just I think it was even like just a couple of days a week. And Kim, who was always Kim, I remember early on took a 2-hour lunch and came back, and they're like, Kim, that was, you were gone 2 hours. And Kim's response was, well, that's how long it took. You know, so Kim really had no, she was herself all the time and had no, she did not bend to norms like that. And as far as paying the bills, you know, we were during the major label years, you know, you take salaries out of budgets and stuff. And, you know, she got by without working and she just, what did she like? She liked baseball. She liked, what did she like to eat? This is funny. Kim would always self-diagnose things. Like if Kim got a cold, she would try to trace it back to, like, I think it was that guy. I shook his hand the other night after that show. I think it was that guy, you know? So Kim in the mid nineties self-diagnosed herself as gluten free. Now, I know this is hip and trendy, and we all know what gluten-free is now, but in the 90s, it was not that easy. And she never went to an allergist or anything. She was gluten-free from that point on in her life. And like I say, at that point, there weren't all these gluten-free products. So she would eat Taco Bell pintos and cheese twice a day sometimes on the road because there was nothing else for her to eat. She was herself all the time. Yeah. I can say it. She was never not Kim.
One of the things I never talked to her about was like where she came from and like why she is the way she is. Because I mean, unique is such a word that people use when talking about her, and observing her for 5 seconds, I think anyone would see that. But you know, I know that she seemed to be really close friends with her sister, but I don't really know how she grew up or if why is she the way she was?
Yeah, she grew up in Southern California. She's one of the rare ones who was born and raised here. So she grew up in, her family lived in Mission Viejo when she was first born, and then they moved to the city of Orange in Orange County. And she was an Orange County girl. I mean, she wasn't like, you know, a beach bunny, you know, type or anything, but she definitely the Southern California influence. I don't even know how to break that down, but she definitely was tried and true California girl. And her parents, you know, very loving and sweet people, very religious. You know, she grew up in a very religious household, and but even like say when she was getting taken to church, Kim looked like Kim how she did in the early Pandora. You know what I mean? She, sorry. I don't know.
Yeah, no. I just, you know, it's just always hard to picture, you know, how does that happen? You know, are you born that way? Do you absorb stuff or is it rebelling against stuff? I don't know. Maybe it's a combination of...
It's probably a combination of everything. Yeah. But she, you know, she had a guitar early on. You know, she had a band that never played out that she had with her boyfriend, you know, pre-Pandoras. They never played or anything. I think, I'm drawing a blank on what the name was. But, God, now that I think about it, I don't mean to go off subject, but that's probably when she first started writing songs.
I'm going to remind folks that Ronnie Barnett is on the phone, and we're talking about the life and the music of Kim Shattuck and the Muffs, and just, you know, terribly sad news. You expect, like, you know, Chuck Berry to die, right? Because he's, like, so old, but you don't really expect people our age to die. It just somehow was real crushing news for so many people. When did you guys play your last show? Did you know it was your last live show?
We did not. Our last show was May 13th, 2017, in Vancouver, at a place called the Commodore Ballroom. We played with our friends the Smugglers and Chicks Dig It, and it was a tremendous show. And we did not know it was our last. You know, everything was still fine. You know, we had worked. We worked steadily for so many years, we just kind of purposefully took the summer off, didn't book any shows. And, you know, we're always friends. Of course, I talked to Kim during the summer, but we got together to do a podcast. You can actually hear this. It's a Bruce Duff podcast. I can't remember what it's called. But in August, she picked me up, and we went to do this. And you can hear, it's very chilling to me now, but you hear on the air her tell me that she can't really grip with her left hand, and that she's going to doctors and something, it's carpal tunnel, blah, blah, blah. And you hear her say, like, you know, I'm sure it's going to be okay. And you hear me say, well, I'm very concerned. And I was always, you know, I'm kind of that way. She couldn't grip with her left hand. That started during the summer of 2017. And she was diagnosed with ALS 2 years ago this month, in October. And that was always a big fear of hers. She had family members that suffered from it. And it was always a fear of hers. Me, her, and Roy were like, well, you know, we'd already been planning our next record and had most of the songs were written. And so at that point, we made plans like, okay, let's go and record. Let's do it this way. Let's flesh out your demos. And so we booked a room in December of 2017 for a couple of days, or actually a day. Roy is unbelievable. Roy did all the drums, and at that point, Kim could still walk. She could still talk, though things were getting a little slurry. Basically, it the disease moved super quick, and she was not able to do those things just months later. Mm-hmm. So, but she did produce this record. She oversaw. We did overdubs. Karen Bassett from the Pandoras. She engineered, and Kim would communicate to it. We were in the bedroom where we'd record the overdubs, and Kim was in the living room listening and giving us direction. She had a machine at that point which would read her eyeball and could communicate for her. So, she oversaw the production of this record. And you know, the record is 18 songs, and you know, they're not all like that. There are about three songs on the record that are fully produced that were kind of left off whoop-de-doo. And they're not outtakes. I was heartbroken that some of those songs didn't actually make the record. But so that's why the record is kind of... A friend of mine compared it to like Maggie Earwig by Guided by Voices, where you have kind of lo-fi-ish stuff next to produced stuff. But somehow it all, you know, meshes into a work that makes sense. And hearing it for the first time, I really cried at how cohesive and how much of a record it sounds like.
I was watching Roy drumming, and I said to Kim, you know, you should get Glyn Johns to produce your next record, because he's like the only person who's going to capture that drum thing the right way, you know? And I was like, I want to help you raise money to do that, right? How much could it be? And then she looked at me like, I'm the Muffs producer, like, F you, you know? She was like, how dare you even, like, suggest, like, Glyn Johns might do a better job than me, you know?
No, I think, Kim, we had so many opinions making our first record that I think at that point, Kim was like, I don't want to compromise and I don't want to listen to other people. And that's when she kind of took over. I know Rob produced our second record with her, but that's when she took, you know, from Happy Birthday to Me, she took over the production and, you know, and that's just how it was.
It's amazing that she produced that record, you know, without talking, and she continued to work, and that, you know, I had heard rumors that she wasn't right, but I really didn't know what was going on, and she really, I kind of... I honor that decision that she made to not share the news publicly. I mean, it just to, you know, stay with her kind of close circle of friends. And
she didn't want Kim was not the type to want pity or you know, as I said before, I know she'd love to see all these tributes, but like, I guess it's hard. One part of me wanted her to kind of get recognition like that.
Yeah.
While she was still here. But on the other hand, yeah, that's how she wanted it. And you know, it's surprising that it, you know, that it was under wraps like that.
Yeah.
Because, there were signals that something was going on.
Yes.
There were no current pictures of her.
Did she have any revelations? I mean, did she, you know, going through that and kind of knowing what was coming, did she...
She was so... we could all only hope to have such a horrible disease. And if people don't know what ALS is, look it up. Because it's really just... It's the cruelest thing... imaginable, because your body has failed you, but your brain is still fully going. So Kim, you know, going over and see Kim, and like I said, she had that device that would talk for her. She remained Kim throughout this illness. She would go over, we would tell old stories, she would smile. We'd walk in, and the machine and the robot voice would say things like, "Your girlfriend has a hairy pussy," and she would just smile. So she was still. Hopefully, I could say that on the air, Michael. I'm sorry.
I don't think so, but
okay.
It's okay.
You know, it's a cat. She was talking about a cat.
Okay. I'm glad to know she was always her until the end. You said I hope everyone. I don't know if I could do it. You know what I mean? I don't know if I could have my brain going, especially a brain like hers. You know, it's just.
No, and she stayed busy. You know, she wrote lyrics for a song on the new Red Cross record. You know, she wrote some lyrics for the Coolies thing that Melanie and Palmyra did with her. She would make playlists. She would watch movies. She'd watch baseball. She never, I got to say, and people, I'm sure, would like to know this, she never lost that smile as much as she couldn't do anything else. Mm. You know, she still had that smile. And you know, she would say, we'd take pictures, and I'd say, "You look great, Kim." And she's like, "I don't think I look so good due to the lack of muscles in my face." But, you know, she's still...
it's truly heartbreaking, and it's just the saddest news, and I'm so sorry for you, and I'm just sorry for the world to lose the Muffs, you know, but the songs will live forever and ever and ever, you know?
Yeah, no, I think so, too. I mean, that's what kept us going all these years. You know, it's not easy to be a band for this long, and still, you know, we could still travel around the world and not be touring a record, you know, and still have people cry in our presence in other countries and want to see us and let us know how much, you know, that they love the band and loved Kim and loved the song.
Oh, yeah. So I mean, I can't reiterate enough. You know, the band is a really, really special band. You know, there's lots of great bands, but there's something really, really special about the Muffs and the songs. And as a songwriter, she is just one of the top 1%. You know, she's like you said earlier, she just had a gift that few people have. And and if you're not on board, you know, get on board now. It's just great. So let's. I got this song from the new record called "Earth Below Me" queued up. If you don't mind, we could hear that. You know, it's funny because listening to the Muffs the past few days, sort of, like every song sort of sounded to me like she was talking about death or talking about dying or talking about legacy. You know, it's funny how often that subject sort of seemed to come up in some ways. You know, she was a lot of her songs are looking backwards, sort of.
Yeah. I can tell you that was not conscious. when she wrote those songs. We've been playing Earth Below Me for a couple of years, and there's one song. Let me look at the record. Late and Sorry. That is one of the ones that was recorded for Whoopi Do, and that's the one where she's saying, "I'm clearly ill," throughout the song, which just chills me now. All this stuff was written before, so if there's any kind of coincidences like that, I mean, that's just that's just the way that it happened. Yeah. It's crazy.
Hey, Ronnie, I hope you still play music. I hope you're not going to retire.
I say this all the time. I mean, the Muscles, my band. I'm not the... I hesitate to even use the word musician in relation to myself, but I'm not the type to say, you know, I don't know, look at musician ads or try to... You know, of course, if Pat Benatar called me or something, of course I would play.
Kiss, again. Yes.
You know, yeah. Yeah, but... You know, yeah, I mean, the Muffs, that was my family, that was my band. I mean, that's you know,
I want to let you know, I think you have the fans' permission. If you want to, you know, still make music, you can.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael. Thanks for being so nice to us over the years. Really been great.
Yeah, thank you for all the number one hit music. I mean, these songs are as good as anything. And it's funny because, like, I got a couple different people said, you put a Muffs song on a mixtape for me, you know, more than one person. It's like, of course, you know, that's what you do. You know, you Johnny Appleseed the good stuff.
We're a big mixtape band. I would hear that all the time from people at shows. Like, yeah, my brother put it, yeah, same deal. Put your song on a mixtape, and I fell in love, and then I went and got the record. Yeah, I've heard that so many times, so that's really, how much more special can you get than that?
Yeah. So the band will continue long after both of us are gone, as mixtapes or whatever it is get spread around. Ronnie Barnett, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's been a terrible, horrible week, and I just give you credit, and I give Kim credit, and Roy, just for... facing the past 2 years. It must have been so tough, and she was lucky to have you guys, and you guys were lucky to have her, you know.
It's so true. Yeah. It's she changed my life, and I love her. You know, not once in the last 2 years did we not just tell each other we love each other constantly. So I know that she knew that, and like you say, it's been a tough couple of years, but you know, I guess we could be glad she's not in that horrible state anymore.
I guess so, yeah.
As much as it pains me to be sad that she's not here.
Oh, yeah, I think we'll just miss her. I mean, that's just all there is to it. There'll be times when you think of a genitalia joke, and you'll be like, I want to pick up the phone and call Kim, and you can't do it, you know?
I'll be thinking of her every day from now on.
Yeah, it's weird that the record comes out in like 2 weeks or less than 2 weeks. Just what weird timing. But
it's a hell of a publicity stunt. Just kidding. We finished it, and originally they wanted to put it out next year, and Kim was like, no, please put it out this year. And so it got pushed up. So really hoping, I'm glad that she got to see some of the initial good reaction to the record, and she got to see the finished product, we have that. So, and she was so proud of this.
All right.
We all are.
I should point out that, like you said, the records are in print. They've a lot of reissued, a lot of great bonus tracks, great remastering and stuff, and the new one comes out soon. Let's hear this track called Earth Below Me, and Ronnie Barnett, thank you so much. My heart is with you, and I think, you know, I hope the positive vibes are making you, help you get through the day, because it's an amazing community, and this lady and your band have just touched so many people. I hope you feel that, and I hope that makes you feel better.
No, it does, and thanks everyone for all the nice stuff.
Yeah.
And Yeah, we all miss her. We all miss her.
Yeah.
And will. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ronnie. Hopefully I'll see you soon.
You're now holiday. Halloween to nothing. And now you're what you do. I'm over it. Maybe I'm a trooper, but that will never do. You know it.